This is the Canadian Mountain Podcast, brought to you by the Canadian Mountain Network. This is episode 2 of the Canadian Mountain Podcast, entitled Connectivity and Shared Spaces. This episode was recorded in April 2017 in Canmore, Alberta, and in studio at the University of Alberta in Edmonton.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Mountain Podcast. I'm Meg Wilcox. Today, we are talking all about Alberta, and specifically work that's happening in the province to protect and even reintroduce animal populations. Later in the show, we're going to head to Canmore to talk more about the bison reintroduction project that's happening in Banff National Park. But first, we're going to talk about bears. Who doesn't love bears? Colleen St. Clair is a biology professor at the University of Alberta in the Faculty of Science, and she'll soon be wrapping up a five-year multi-million dollar research project in conjunction with Parks Canada and CP Rail. And it's looking at wildlife fatalities on and near rail lines. In particular, it's looking at bear fatalities. And joining her is Jonathan Bax. He's a PhD student in materials engineering and ecology at the University of Alberta, and his research work is part of this program. So he's been building and testing a system that warns wildlife to oncoming trains. So thank you so much for joining you guys.
You're welcome, Meg.
Thanks for having me.
So first, Colleen, I know that 5 years of research is really big in scope, but how do you explain your project to someone who may not have heard of it before?
I'll take a stab at it. If folks haven't heard, there's been a rising problem over the last 15 years of grizzly bears being struck by trains in Banff and Yoho National Parks. That's known to occur, has occurred periodically in the past, but it seems in this location that it's been increasing in frequency. 17 bears have died by being hit by trains in that area over this past 17-year period. So what we've been trying to do is figure out the root causes for that vulnerability. It does seem to have risen quite suddenly. And from that knowledge, figure out how it can be mitigated to reduce that likelihood in future.
And so you're doing this work with Parks Canada as well as CP Rail. Tell me, how exactly do all these partners come together and contribute to the body of research that's happening?
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual initiative. It was begun actually by CP Rail. They were the ones that put up $1 million, offered it to Parks as the start of a research project, hoping to have research address those two issues, the root causes and potential mitigation. Parks joined them in an initiative, a grizzly bear conservation initiative. They advertised their intent quite broadly. They hosted a workshop. I was one of many people who was invited to attend. We discussed the problem for a couple of days, and they announced the formation of this research fund, to which I and many others applied. We were awarded funding from that initiative, and Parks Canada also received some dedicated funding, but they put together with it many resources of their own. By virtue of my position at the university, I could apply for some additional funding from the federal government that's intended to encourage industry to do exactly the kind of thing that CP did. So together we brought probably about $3 million into a collection to spend on the U of A component of this five-year project that involved the graduate work of four students and several undergraduate assistants, several interns coming from overseas, usually as volunteers, and three postdoctoral fellows. So each of those tackled a different dimension of the project, and we had fantastic cooperation and support and expertise and, of course, access from both CP and Parks. So I would say every part of what we did in this project could only really be done in such a cooperative environment, right from a really basic pragmatic problem of the fact that the rail is actually private property, and we couldn't even be on the rail working on the problem without that cooperation from CP, but extending to many things that are a little bit harder to spot from the outside, including decades-old databases from Parks Canada and accumulations of probably hundreds of person years worth of knowledge by its warden staff.
So when you think of the three parts of this, right, we look at the academic side, we look at Parks, we look at CP Rail. They're all very different organizations with very different goals, generally speaking,
yeah,
in what
yeah,
they
for
do.
Sure.
So how do you balance all three of those in this work?
Well, I'd be the first to admit that it is sometimes really tricky. We got off to quite a slow start, for example, because the view that CP had as a corporation about the ownership of data was completely different from the view that NSERC had as a funding body of primarily basic research. And we had to have discussions to negotiate a way of achieving the ideals of each organization around security and intellectual property and integrity of publishing, so that everybody could have the things that were really central to their mandates. But I think those very challenges were also one of the reasons that the collaboration, I feel, has been quite a successful one. You mentioned that we all had different core purposes, and that meant that we brought those core purposes always to each other. So we had to balance in an ongoing way the pragmatism and operational realities of a major transcontinental railway. We had to balance that with the protection of a public resource for the public interest that is the mandate of Parks Canada. And we had to balance, for both of them, the safety not only of the bears and other wildlife, but of people working on the rail, not just our crew, but other people working for Parks or CP, and a host of other environmental, social, economic things that came with that. So although it was tricky to balance those things sometimes, I think it was a good outcome, and I like to think I brought a healthy balance, too, with the rigor and the scholarly traditions of a university, our commitment from the beginning to peer-reviewed publications that are in progress or published now. And together, I think we ended up with a whole that was more than the sum of the parts.
In terms of the challenges that you faced, as you mentioned, there's obviously a lot of moving parts, and there's just the nature of research work in general. What was one of the biggest challenges you felt that you and your team had to overcome or find a workaround for in the work that you were doing?
That's a great question. I would say it wasn't actually in the nature of the collaboration, although that was recurrently challenging. We were always able to solve those challenges. I would say the biggest unsolved challenge is actually the ecological complexity of this problem. The more things we studied, the more things we found that made contributions, it seemed, to the vulnerability of bears to strikes. But none of them, not a single one, has turned out to be strongly explanatory alone. So, for example, grain is spilled along the railway, and grain attracts animals, not just bears, to forage on it. But not all animals within any of those populations seem to care for it. It doesn't attract all animals or in equal measure. And yet, there are a lot of other things along the rail that attract animals, some of which we didn't anticipate at all. For example, buffalo berry, a staple food of bears in the park, grows along the railway right of line, but the rail causes it to produce more berries that ripen earlier, but also fall off the bushes earlier. So trying to weave all these things together in the way they affect the distribution of the bears and their likelihood of being on the tracks and where and when they're on the tracks and their likelihood of being struck, those have all turned out to be much more complicated than we had even imagined at the outset.
Well, and I imagine in 5 years of research, there have been a lot of surprises. What have been some of the major discoveries that you've been that you're able to take forward in the research in the future?
I know Jonathan will talk in a moment about one of my favorite discoveries. It's an invention based on what we came to believe was the sort of suite of predictive characteristics that might yield a place with greater likelihood of strikes. So it's a mitigation to address that. But there were other surprises that might explain some of the broader patterns. For example, we discovered that red squirrels, those innocuous little tree squirrels, collect grain all winter long while bears are sleeping. They cache it in their middens, planning to eat it later. Bears, with their super-sensing noses, find those middens full of grain, and they dig them up and eat the grain. They don't bother doing that for spruce cones, which is the normal food of red squirrels at these elevations. But they do that for the seeds of whitebark pine. So it seems like there's this sort of three-way interaction between the grizzly bears, the red squirrels, maybe five-way. The whitebark pine, which generates the beginning of a behavior that's been translated now to red squirrels at lower elevations and their caches of grain. We think that might be part of how bears learn to eat grain and target grain as a food resource. And as far as we can find, nobody has seen such a thing in the literature where one animal, one wild animal, food conditions another wild animal to a human origin food source. Mm. So that's just one of many, many examples. There's been quite a few of things we weren't really looking for. We discovered them incidentally, and we've worked out how they might be tied to the bigger picture of vulnerability.
Through your research, what do you think was something that was sort of taken as a likelihood that you've discovered is totally not relevant?
Well, despite the disappointment of so many things that we thought might be real smoking guns that would explain vulnerability very well, for example, the presence of high curvature in the track next to very steep slopes, especially if there was a water body on one side. We thought that was going to leap out of our analyses. It didn't. So I can't say that there's anything that we've looked at that I've concluded has absolutely no effect on vulnerability. Instead, it's like a multidimensional slurry of gray where things have different relative effects, and their relative effects are further changed by context, day, night, season, location, and further changed by individual, and individuals further change each other. One of the bears in our study population seems to be defending the rail from other bears. We think he's doing that not because of the grain or the vegetation, but because he parades along the rail looking, we think, for ungulates that have been struck by trains, which occurs wherever ungulates and trains co-occur. And those are pretty high-value finds for a grizzly bear, and when he finds them, he wants to keep other bears off of them, and he's big enough to do it. So in a weird kind of way, he might be protecting other bears from strikes. And except for four now cubs, there have been no strikes on adult bears in the last several years.
Interesting. Mm. And then we think that all these animals, yeah, they have their own unique lives and habits and ways that they integrate within their environment.
Mm.
That just adds so many interesting dynamics to what
we're researching. Yeah, it really does. It's very humbling. But I do think we're closer to understanding some of these dynamics. And I think we will have a suite of generalities that can be lent to other jurisdictions, maybe ones that don't have the same kind of resources that we were lucky enough to have to study this problem in a pretty comprehensive way. And maybe we can also save some of those other jurisdictions some steps and things that they mightn't bother to look into based on our results.
Wonderful. So Jonathan, looking at your work specifically, you have been developing a warning system for wildlife for oncoming trains. So tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, so we tried to approach this problem from a more immediate perspective of an animal on the railway tracks when a train is approaching. Mm. Now we know from personal experience that, of course, around a railway curve, for example, it can be very difficult to see a train. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of surprising that in some cases it's also really difficult to hear trains that are coming. I mean, in some cases you can hear them from miles away. In other cases, for whatever reason, you see them before you hear them. And that can be quite alarming, certainly for us, knowing what a train is and what it can do to people. But we're also suspicious that it might create a similar feeling for animals, where on the rare occasion that they get surprised by a train, they mm-hmm. might actually make a bad decision about how they retreat from the train, and that could ultimately result in them being killed by the train.
Mm.
So what we want to try to do is look for these locations where it's really hard to detect an incoming train. And at those locations, we would provide a warning signal to the animals that might be there, so that no matter what kind of train is approaching, the animals are always going to have that consistent early warning.
So tell me about the actual warning system itself. What does it look like, and how does it work?
Hmm.
Right. So I invented this device, or system of devices, that is installed on and around the railway track to first detect trains on either side of, say, this vulnerable zone that you've identified. And then these train detecting devices, about the size of a loaf of bread, send a radio signal down the track to warning devices that you place within this vulnerable zone. And those warning devices emit lights and sounds of a very specific type that we hope that animals will learn to associate with the trains that are coming in at exactly 30 seconds later.
So 30 seconds, why 30 seconds of warning?
And that's a really interesting question, because if you've ever watched an LRT train here in Edmonton or a C train in Calgary cross a road, you'll know that the flashing lights and bell sounds and barrier arms come down consistently before that train arrives. And if you actually time that on a stopwatch, you'll find that it's pretty close to 30 seconds. So given the effectiveness of that type of signal for humans, we are trying to basically do the same thing, but in the middle of the wilderness for animals.
So you have these set up right now. How much longer are you going to be keeping the warning systems up and gathering data in the field?
At least a couple of more months, potentially. We need to collect a lot of data because these camera systems activate every time a train goes by, but it's only one in 100 train passages where you'll see any animal at all in this particular area. So very, very exciting information, but it arrives at a low density.
You're watching a lot of trains go by before you're seeing any elk or any other action.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So the other thing that you've done with this work that's really interesting is you've chosen to make it available as open source so that other people can see and follow and use this. Also, as you mentioned, the wildlife warning system doesn't have to be installed by the organization that's put in the railway tracks. You can clip it to tracks that already exist. And I'm curious as to why this was something that you chose to integrate into your research.
Well, there's two big reasons as I see it. For one, because so much of our funding for this work came from the Canadian government and ultimately the Canadian taxpayers, I see it as being a situation where they've already paid for this work, and I see no reason that they should have to pay for it again through a patent process and some private company that would sell these devices or the concept to other companies. Secondly, like you alluded to, I really want to make sure that the technology, if it's helpful, is as widely available as possible to maximize the chances of somebody using it for the benefit of wildlife in Canada and around the world.
So what would be your hope or expectation with this work and how it might be used by other agencies, organizations, or other parts of Canada or the world? What would you like to see?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to determine whether it's actually helpful for the animals, and that's the experiment we're doing right now. But following that, I'll need to do some more learning perhaps and talking with CP about how we can move forward into longer term testing and potentially development of some means, whether that be public or private, to get this technology to other places in Canada and the world.
That's the next PhD, right?
Sure.
This one wasn't painful enough.
So in terms of thinking, you know, like over this amount, like 5 years, I'm thinking of research, you know, and these long-term projects, what are you hoping for to come out of all of this and how this research is used in the future? I know we've talked about your project in specific, Jonathan, but I'm thinking Colleen just in general.
Yeah, John did a good job of describing my sense of those bigger goals. We do very much want to provide answers to the first questions. What are the root causes of this vulnerability that seems to have arisen quite suddenly for grizzly bears to train strikes in this location? And knowing that, what can be done to mitigate that probability? That's task number one. From there, we really hope to have answered those questions in ways that could be applied to other jurisdictions, not just all the other mountainous areas in Alberta and BC that have trains and wildlife with similar collision circumstances, but the many places around the world that have larger wildlife populations, or perhaps more difficult topography and very little ability to study these things. So if we've come up with a device that has the potential to be applied, it's not only open source, but Jonathan dedicated a lot of effort to making it quite affordable. So it's about $230 worth of materials to make this little device, with an intention that it works conceptually and practically very much like the crossing signals work for a conventional railway for people. So when you approach the LRT in Calgary, you hear the dinging of the bell, you see the flashing of the lights, you know, you can count on that signal to know a train is coming. There's no need to dash across the tracks or look for change between them, because you can just wait a minute or so for that train to go by, and we think wildlife can learn that as well. So in addition to all of these pragmatic benefits, I think there's some fairly exciting potential to demonstrate a kind of animal learning in the context of mitigation that might have the potential to apply in all kinds of other ways that have been so far fairly untapped.
We hear so much about, you know, wanting, especially within academia, to incorporate more with industry. And I'm wondering, do you see any other potential ways that for this area of research, maybe other organizations or other forms of industry that also could maybe get on board or contribute to help build more research and understanding around these types of topics?
Yeah, sure. I think we both do. We've discussed fairly often how the same technology for the rail could apply to people on the rail. About 400 people a year are killed on rails in the U.S. But it could also apply to roadways, and that might be especially important in places where people or wildlife have reason to be understimulated by the sensory information that we usually count on to protect us from being hit by vehicles. So there might be sound pollution, or it might be particularly applicable to install near the home of a blind child. There's all kinds of things like that. And then generalizing to the principle that associative learning could be used to warn animals of human-caused dangers, I think the sky's the limit. To date, associative learning has been used in wildlife management mostly as some form of punishment to dissuade animals from doing something we don't want them to do, or as some form of lure to convince them to do something they don't want to do but we'd like them to do. Land here, ducks. There's a whole other realm that associative learning could be used in, though, this one, to simply inform wildlife of contexts that could be dangerous for them in context-specific ways that they can't detect for themselves. So I bet you can imagine a lot of times when that might apply to for all kinds of wildlife and all kinds of outdoor situations.
Yeah, finally sort of bridging that gap between the human-made elements that they don't understand because we've introduced them and let them make their decisions from there.
Exactly.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me, you guys.
You're really welcome. Thanks for your interest.
That's Colleen St. Clair. She's a biology professor at the Faculty of Science at the University of Alberta. Jonathan Baggs is a PhD student at the University of Alberta as well. And next, we're going to be heading to Canmore, and we're going to learn more about the bison reintroduction program that's happening in Banff National Park. And it was just after years and years of planning and consideration, it was only just a few months ago, in February 2017, that bison first returned to Banff National Park. Welcome back to the Canadian Mountain Podcast. I'm Meg Wilcox, and joining me is William Snow and Marie-Ève Marchand. We're currently in the Day Lodge at the Canmore Nordic Centre, preparing for Bear Days, which will be happening this weekend. Marie-Ève Marchand is from Bison Belong, and William Snow is the consultation manager for the Stoney Nakoda Nation. And today we were going to chat about bison in Banff National Park, because it's been now 3 months that they're back, which is pretty great.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah, very exciting, yeah.
So tell me, what exactly is the story of bison in Banff National Park?
Well, buffalo have been in the Bow Valley for many years. Going back, there have been remains found within Banff National Park going back at least 10,000 years. And a lot of that history is really not known, and I think that, you know, there's more publications and more research being done on bison in different areas, and that's good. And you know, we need to really take a second look at all of the history of wildlife within important corridors like the Bow Valley.
And so, looking at bison, how did they leave? How did they go?
So if we go back in history, it's about 140 years ago. Bison, so right at the beginning of the settler coming in, and then the bisons were roaming in the prairies, and we're talking about from Mexico all the way up to Alaska, but for the plain bison, it's pretty much the area around Edmonton and all the way down. And then the population really diminished over. We're talking about 30 to 60 million bisons, and within 15 to 20 years, we went down to 64 individuals.
Oh, wow.
All across North America. And those individuals were in really different pockets. And the story of the conservation in North America pretty much started with the bison, saving a species from extinction. So before that, we had, like, you can imagine the Great Plains of North America, like the Serengeti, with the antelope roaming, with the bison, the elk, the deer, the grizzly bear, the wolf, and suddenly within not even a generation, it kind of was all gone. And then some people with really some foresight, but it came from First Nation who had the really foresight of saving some bison, and then some other white people across North America. And we were kind of, Banff National Park was at the center of that. At one point in late 1800, early 1900, the Kootenai, Salish, Pend'Oreille people had saved some bison from the east side of the mountain, from the Blackfoot territory, brought it down on the west side, what we call like really near Kalispell, and the population of the bison grew. There's some really hacked, the allotment hacked to came in the U.S., so meaning dividing the reservation, bison had to go, and the U.S. government didn't want to buy the bison. So they turned around to Canadian, and Canada decided to do it. And it came out to the Banff National Park at the time, Rocky Mountain and Norman Luxton, and they got the money from the federal, and for 5 or 6 years, they round up wild bison. And it's really interesting, as we're talking this year, we brought 16 bison to Banff with all the technology and the knowledge. Can you imagine in 1905 bringing like 700 bison, that those bison were not 2 years old, but full grown adult,
oh, wow,
and wild bison, and putting them into train? And at some part of the train being in Banff, and for over 100 years, we had bison in Banff, but always in a paddock, so in an enclosure fence. Mm-hmm. And that's what really special with this year is, for the first time, yes, they are in a soft pasture at the moment, but we're bringing them back to be wild, to be free, not to be fenced anymore. And that's the first time in over 140 years that this time in Banff, within a few months, they will be roaming around the valleys of the Pender.
Wow. And so, when we think about bringing them back, as you said, they've been in the park in varying ways. How did the conversation to even bring bison back to Banff start?
Well, I think this is a part of a process that's been underway for a number of years. This is not the first time that Parks has tried to bring buffalo into the parks, and those efforts previously did not involve a lot of First Nations or other groups in order to try and facilitate that. And so this time around, in this cycle of trying to reintroduce bison into the national parks, we began talking early on with Parks, and Parks, I think, reached out to a lot of different groups to get their take on how this should be done. And I think one of the reasons why it should be done is because of all of the functions that buffalo perform on landscapes, all of the biodiversity that buffaloes bring with them being on part of the landscape. Wes Olson talks a lot about this in his work, all of the different types of insects, all of the different other ungulates, fish species, birds that naturally come into areas where bison are normally habitating. And so I think for all of those kind of reasons for strengthening biodiversity, I think that's a really important part of why it's done. The other why as to why it's done is also cultural. indigenous people have regarded the bison as a very important part of the culture. Bison skulls are still used today in many of the important ceremonies. And because of that, the bison has always had a special place, not only within the culture, but as a religious symbol for many indigenous nations. And so for that reason, and for all of the other intangibles that are associated with buffalo, I think that's another reason why it gained support to bring bison back to the landscape, Banff National Park.
So the conversation started, how long did it take to actually, if we think that, you know, February 1st was sort of landing day, we'll talk about that in a minute, how long did it take to actually make this come together?
So it really started when the bison paddock was taken down in 96. And that was for, as William was mentioning, for connectivity reason. And it's one of the first cases in the world, actually, of restoring connectivity in a landscape. So they took not only the bison paddock, but they took the airstrip, the cadet camp, and all around the Cascade Mountain, because with the development of the town and the activities and the paddock that was there with the airport and the cadet camp, created like this big wall for wolves. So you had like this momentum where we had like numerous elk inside the town of Banff, the town site, but the wolf couldn't get in. And we really had created so that the bison had to go. So we're talking 96, the conversation started then. Why are we not letting them be free? So it's over two decades of conversation, but I think when you're looking at this time period, it's really, I think the buffalo was ready to be back. And the buffalo had to want it to be back in the time, and it took over 20 years for some people to catch on, for the system to be able to move on. And in the case of Bison Belong, we started in 2008 because we was like, unless someone kind of create energy and we help gather the energy and push a little bit, it might take another 20 years. So we started to kind of poke around and help see who else is interested and support Parks Canada and the ideas. And that's how it came with the Buffalo Treaty and many First Nations. We realized that a lot of people were thinking about it, and those voices came together, and 21 years later.
21 years later. You mentioned the fact that there are so many different parties to this, right? We have the indigenous groups, we also have the people working in conservation and parks, the people that use parks, all of that too. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how you integrate these voices and what kind of steps it took to bring this together.
Well, one of the steps that we took as Stoney Nakoda was we went out and brought in, we've had a herd of buffalo out at the reserve since the early 1970s. So, and we've been managing that herd in that time period. And you know, practices and usage and harvesting them in ways that are culturally appropriate for our nation. And you know, we've also invited parks in this period to come out and to see this herd, and to understand some of the practices that we use around managing the herd, and just to see how the landscape is being used by buffalo. The landscape at Stone Indian Park out at the Morley Reserve, I think that's very similar to the area up at Panther Dormer, where you have a river close by, and you have open lands, and you have mountains in an enclosed area, and so it's very similar to what is being experienced by the reintroduction herd. And so we reached out and we brought in. This was of course during the time of the American Bison Association meeting that was held here at the Banff Center in September of 2016. And you know, we had a chance to bring in some of those folks, as well as Parks Canada, to come in and see the herd. So I think, you know, we've been trying to include that kind of an awareness, and we've tried to include groups to come out and see the herd.
And Marie-Ève, on your side, thinking about the different groups that are coming together to make this happen, what have been some of the steps along the way?
It's been a very interesting journey. So right at the beginning, the idea of wasn't to create a campaign, Bison Belong, was to create a movement or create a space where everyone could come and bring something to the table wherever they were coming from. So it was like we approached companies like Ski Big Tree became a big supporter, so bring the bison. And then you had restaurants, and then you had stores, and you had like local business owner, but you also had artists. I don't know if some people have been in Banff. If you go to the Safeway, like there's this big like electrical box. And a few years ago, bison appeared on it as a painting because I was an artist who was like, you know, I heard about the bison coming back and I dream of those, and she painted it. So now you drive in Kenmore and you see them in those electrical boxes. And that was about 3 or 4 years ago that they started to appear. And then another store wanted to open and it's like in Kenmore, and they're like, we're opening a bar, we like cocktails, and I think we're going to call it Where the Buffalo Roam. And they connected with me, and then we looked at colors like make this is a good idea. And it was just like, yeah, it kind of came, it called us. But he also had like small business owner who just wanted to do something. And some of them, like we had for a few years, like a postcard campaign to really show the supports. And it was interesting because it was a good way to engage with the visitors, which a good portion of the visitors in Banff National Park comes from other countries, but a lot of them comes from Alberta and Canada, to be aware. And it's within museum and stores of people say, give me some, I'll make the people sign, I'll let them be aware. And everyone came together doing like so many different strategies that it came to, in 2014, the Banff Avenue Brewery. It's like, you know, we do cheddar ED beer, but we always do it like on the very short term of something to help. What about we do a Bison Homeward Pale Ale? I was like, yeah, that's great. And to that, a lot of local restaurants who never had local beers before to be served decided that for the bison, they will bring a local beer and they'll support. And all them together, it was 14 restaurants came with the brewery, and it was something that didn't happen as a collaboration.
Well, to be fair, that beer was delicious, so that helped too.
It was a good tasting beer, but it's all those little things that came in, and it was from, I would say, the arts play a big role, and music and musician coming with sounds and business finding the ways, but it's also to that process is what was interesting. And William is talking that the bison is an ecological process. It's more than just a species. He's the landscaper of our landscape. We think of Africa, of the elephant being the landscaper. What we forgot is the bison is our elephant. He's the one who defines the Great Plains, and we've been missing it. But he also brought with the First Nation to the Buffalo Tree and many nations to start to listen to that wrong that we did, and why are we doing righting a wrong? Because actually, they didn't disappear because of a disease. They really disappeared because the gun came in and we overhunted them in a very short period. And it's very interesting that opening of listening to those stories, or just getting to be aware and understanding the deep cultural meaning that it was more than an ecological species that we were trying to do. It was really bringing the species, the processes, and the culture back together to Banff National Park.
Well, and I guess that brings up the question that now that the bison are back, what are the hopes or expectations? How is this going to change the region, change the landscape, change the people that are here?
Well, I think it's going to change not only the environment in which they are situated, and change other wildlife in that area. I think it's also going to have a change effect within the indigenous nations. And the reason for that is when we've always considered that buffalo being in their places, they act very much in the way of spirits and guardians do for areas. And this is really why, looking at projects like the renaming of Tunnel Mountain and the process that we went through in order to understand all of those stories that are representative of the Tunnel Mountain, and which is why we came up with that particular name for the name change that we've proposed through the Buffalo Treaty Resolution. Sacred Buffalo Guardian Mountain is the translation that we've come up with, because that is the representation of the meaning of that place for the Stoney people. And so that's why we went through this process, and I think that's just one of the cultural changes in understanding landscapes, understanding place names, understanding special places within parks, not just the names that we have now, but the traditional names for places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as William was talking about for the people, and we need to remember, like, we people see Banff National Park as those big rocky peaks and ice and like snow, but the eastern slope where the bisons are in the Panther Valley, it's called Eastern Slope for a reason. It's that sea of green grass and hilly country that not many people affiliated with Banff. And it's really interesting, the first birds who came to see the bison the second day were there was the gray jay, the Canadian bird, our national bird. And he came over, and apparently there's two of them who just came and kind of giggle looking at who are those coming back in our landscape. And they spent in the morning, and every morning they came back after to look at them. And they started to pick a little bit of fur. And it's really important, like William was mentioning, but for the birds, this fur that the bison shed will increase at least 30% their chance for their chick to survive, because they'll weave that fur inside their nest, and that creates like an insulation. Those frisky little morning in the spring that we have with sometimes a little fresh snow, those little eggs will be in way more warmer because of the bison fur, and that's been missing. And William was talking on the ecology, so interesting, because the bison, the first thing that they did when they got in the landscape, they ate, and then they poop. And they have this patty on the ground. But those patties are home to about 1,000 insects each. Those insects multiply by, at the moment, 16 bisons, eating and pooing much of the days. But those thousands of insects that will be there for the migratory birds this spring and this fall, we're creating a new space of feeding for all the species that's flying over that hasn't been there. But then we're looking at, like, the gophers, or we can look at the ground squirrels, and then we can look at the birds, and they all interact with the bison. It's a very interesting to see how many species will be, and we talk about the fish because they do with the water have a very different relationship. And I think it's very interesting because it brought this, we know we hear about keystone species and we know about the effects of an animal in the landscape, and the most common one that we talk about it was the reintroduction of wolf in Yellowstone National Park. What we're not talking about is we did reintroduce the elk to Banff National Park from Yellowstone when they were almost all killed like the bison, but we never did for the bison. So our system hasn't been whole, and our relationship with nature, which is also a relationship with the First Nation and the Métis in this landscape, has been missing. And I think the bison is a bit of a portal of people to start listening and opening to, what does that mean that the landscape is not full or that it's a missing species? And I think bisons are really great to tell us stories. They are not only the symbol of the RCMP, I think they're a symbol of the next 150 years where we're going together.
Well, I find it funny that you mentioned the birds, because the bison were delivered from the sky. It's tricky to get 16 bison into the landscape. Tell me a bit about how that happened.
So it's a roadless area where they came in. The road stops about 25 kilometers before. So they drove late afternoon from Elk Allen, close to Edmonton, east of Edmonton, drove down to the end of the road, which is at the Yahatinda Ranch. The Yahatinda Ranch is a federal managed by Parks Canada. They spent the night in their crater, and then they really, like, Parks Canada had to find the best helicopter out of the West Coast who do like those extra big trees logging and really heavy duty helicopter. And they had to find a way to bring those crates with 3 to 4 bison each. But you know, if you put a crate on the with a rope with the helicopter, the crate might do just spin around. Mm-hmm. So they figured out that they had to put like a parachute.
Mm-hmm. Parachute, yeah.
The parachutes on the other side to keep them from spinning as they flew. It was a 25-minute flight that those bison took in. And when they put them, and they had four flights, each of the crates, till they had all the five flights. And then they let them down all together on the landscape. They let it view for a few minutes, and then they opened all the gates together. And when you look at that footage of that energy coming back on the landscape, it's just like they knew they belonged there.
Were they okay? Were they like helicopter sick? Like,
none of them were sick, and it's very interesting because there's 16 of them. 10 of them, they all 2 years old, so they all young. They only had 1 year in Elk Allen, so they're not fully habituated in the landscape over there. And 10 of them are pregnant. So the next few weeks, actually, there'll be like 25, 26 of them coming very soon, and those little red dogs are coming to run the landscape, and they will know nowhere else than Banff. So I think that's, and all the moms are healthy at the moment, so that's a good sign.
So thinking about this now, it's 3 months in, but we're about to see a whole new generation, almost doubling the size of the number of bison there. What are your hopes now that the bison are back in Banff?
Well, the hope is that the landscape will be changed. I think we're all seeing different effects of climate change in different areas, and because of that, we have many different water issues with logging and with other impacts on landscapes from development. And so I think the real hope here is that that buffaloes will be able to provide a regenerative bring biodiversity to areas that are sorely in need of revitalization, not just affecting the landscape and the vegetation, but also affecting all of the different the wildlife that accompanies it. And so that's our hope, is that these areas will be rejuvenated and that we will be able to see the biodiversity that existed there previously.
And I think my hope to William, I think my hope is that people, we're in a buffalo landscape. On the West Coast, you know, it's a lot about salmon. But if you move from the Continental Divide east in the Great Plains, we're in buffalo landscape, and we need to understand what it means as a biocultural importance. There's the ecology, but there's all the cultural. And I think that a lot of people, by bringing bison in Canada's first national park, it wasn't a small feast. The number is not that big, but it will hold by the time the soft pasture, they will have about 35 to 40 when they'll start roaming free. So June-ish 2018, they'll have 1,200 square kilometers of roaming as the moments they're still in the pasture to keep them and making sure they stay. But that will learn a lot more by next summer about what does it mean for all the First Nation, for the Stoney Nakoda, for the Cree, for the Blackfoot, the Shuswap, and even the Tanaha people. What it is their relationship with the buffalo, the bison, and why are we not talking about it, and why haven't we talked about it for 150 years? And I think that's really my hope, that it's not only a physical landscape, but it's a cultural landscape of people that will be changed.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today, you guys. And William, I know that you have some friends out and that you're actually setting up a teepee outside now.
Yes.
So we should go check that out.
Ambo Wastich. My name is Bill Snow. I'm the consultation manager with Stoney Nakoda Nation, and we are here out at the Canmore Nordic Center in Canmore, Alberta. Today we're here to talk about the cultural importance of bison in the Bow Valley, cultural importance of buffalo to the Stoney Nakoda people, and we're here with Council Member Hank Snow, and also with Elder Charlie Rabbit from the Wesley First Nation. So maybe if we could pose that question about the cultural importance of buffalo, pose that in a translation to Elder Charlie.
Nogadne tandu chihan duken wachim chabi.
Nogadne tandu chihan and chau dabu adna. So double chance I need to some yen she jabs you and was ninja and sacktibians. Shoop tens in the march up over Wabuana, I should not be thin yik to none, a bigger stuck yab service didn't.
Yes, the one of the main ones was for food. Food was key for the buffalo. He's saying that in the winter time, when they killed a buffalo, when they went to gut it, once they opened the stomach, then they put their hands in there to warm up their hands. So it's a way to keep warm too during that time of cutting and skinning the buffalo. But mainly it was a food source, shelter. Back before, it was more of, was used for everything.
And maybe just a little bit
about the, we recently took down a few buffalo out at the buffalo paddock at Stone Indian Park. And we did that for a cultural purpose, to have a feast with nation members this past March. But in order to do that, we followed a lot of protocols before we took out the buffalo from the herd.
Back when the buffalo were introduced into or brought back to Morley, it was a time when the buffalo were struggling. They were almost extinct. So the elders at the time saw it appropriate to bring the buffalo back and kind of keep them in Morley. And then there was a Stony Ecumenical Conference that was held there every year back in the 70s. And they started to utilize the buffalo as part of the meal for the conference there. And they did it ceremonially. They did a pipe ceremony, the songs, traditionally. So this, a few years ago, I would say 10 years ago, we did the same thing. So every year we're starting to try and maybe reintroduce both the ceremony and to go back to using the buffalo for food, because it's really healthy. And we in February there, we brought out some kids, and we did the whole process. We did a ceremony, pipe ceremony. We sang some songs, and then after the kill, we some of them ate the liver, some of them drank the blood. It was ceremonial to do that, and then we took it home, and the young ladies prepared it. They made dry meat, and then they smoked the ribs, and then in March 22, we did a round dance. We invited all visitors to come from all over Alberta here and then into Saskatchewan to come and join us in a feast to honor and to celebrate this buffalo kill that the youth did. It was the youth. We brought the youth in to do the whole process, the shooting, the skinning, also preparing it, the young ladies, and then at the round dance, it was a youth that served it to the elders. So it was just kind of keeping in tradition where they were trying to teach our youth the respect of the animal, that you don't just go out and kill this the buffalo for no reason. There was a purpose, and there was a ceremony along with that. So that's what we were trying to emphasize to our youth, that this was how it was done, and it worked out really good.
And maybe Charlie can share a memory or two from the feast, or how those were done in years past.
Tanin gan. Gan me mea wai chibi ken sen no ga tano I dab ke do catch it chaniu I mai sis I tanin ni sis he chen je ham chai sis du ken tin ja ga chi chani
ya tanin dar ka ki hek ta ta stop je si un chau da bu an no ga ne kakin 1800 and 90 dukta si hansa stab je os mo wan te jan se ni hogam ta stab ne no wan ya kis a hun cha pab no din na to pab ne no wan no hun cha pab na to skus cha aktivis ne cha ka ba fin di ande si hans 1949 48 si ha Norman Lexton see buffalo and check the big can, sounds a good using. Won't check who be here, son. It's a hitching him, son. It's in hitching someone, Jesus. It's a zin who up. Then not to up on this home shop of one. Sickness of home shop of it. No one, I hope of it. No habits and it's a man, Tejan, the evening. It's a home shop of one, anecdotes. Says Yaki Hector, the Siwa Kitty, Chiha Pandy, Sihon's activity. Pandy looked to do us, being shabby. So has it new hogum? It's a job, it's some in the day. See, even shabby, seems some mob one.
When back in the early 1800s, the buffalo was the main source of food, so they were relied on the buffalo until the time where the buffalo were almost exterminated. So remembering back, he was talking about the 1940s during the Bath Indian days when Norman Luxton would go and kill some buffalo and give it to the families at the Bath Indian days. I don't know if he did it through ceremony, probably not, but the ceremony, the sun dance is key to the buffalo too. It's they use the buffalo skull in the sun dance because the buffalo was the source of livelihood back in that day. So some of the buffaloes that the skulls that were utilized came from the buffaloes that were killed prior to almost extinction.
Yeah. And Melanie, just a little bit about when we have our discussions, especially with groups like the South Saskatchewan Regional Plan, and we talk about the use of animals or the wide range of traditional territories, not just for Stoney, but for other bands. And that whole territory is used for that reason, to gather animals in all of these different regions. So that's why I think it's important for all the bands to be participating with the government in all their frameworks, because it's those management people that really need to hear this from all the nations, that they do use these areas for all different types of purposes, harvesting being one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And that part is what we continue to talk about with SSRP. And so it's good to be working with you and Dawn, especially within Kananaskis, on all of the different projects that are happening. So, great. One more story about if Charlie wants to share about Banff Indian Days.
Banff Indian Days, every year it's one thing. See, huh? That's stubborn. Indian Days, and I guess Tanga no obituan. It's he. There are some things, Kisniminsa. Eating a cheap John Bamp and Disney. Tis many days. What come near the abjis? Since just the other minches. A diak tanta kibiches kiss name in the one or reha. Tongashinta, you were nagisana. Ningumene parinis. Tis a zinis. Tijabi to modern the Bamp. And then this you have a cynic tossum. They make questions. When you are done, so she do high since stone is sitting in. She was on my chord. They has most magnesium. It's in. She was do his a hogum. And he said, no maker to go hang us. That she was more like the keep one. It's in no maker Indian days. Sitting to harbor John, what must the end day you harbor it? In the night you harbor it, you are going to high with it. northeast, the northwest of the Umnuptan, and then there you have the Abidna.
Oh, yeah, he's talking about the Banff Indian Days. Banff Indian Days was a big event back in the day. When it first started in the early part of the 1800s, the people went to the Banff Indian Days not only for celebration, but also for healing. The Lake Minnewaka waters were for healing, and the waterfalls at Cascade. And we and our name for the waterfalls is Minnehpa. Minnehpa also means the Banff area. So we don't call it Banff, we call it Minnehpa in Nakoda. He's saying back in the day, before, way before the Banff parks, that was our place to go and heal. That was our ceremonial places, because there used to be sun dances that were done underneath the Cascade Mountain. There were sun dances there, and they went to the different areas, the hot springs, Cave and Basin, all that, those areas for healing. There was a healing place, that whole area, so it was passed on for many thousands of years that they knew that all that was in place there, all the different medicines that were there that are not here at the plains or where we're at now. So the medicines that we did gather up there in the Banff, in the park back in the day, for the last 70 years we were prevented from gathering our medicines and getting the healing that was involved within the culture, within the Nakoda culture.
And now we'd like to talk a little bit about some of the ceremonies that were done for the bison reintroduction. When the Stonies did the ceremony for the initial Buffalo Treaty signing, that was in 2015, and that was done for the Banff Indian Days out at the Indian Grounds. And then in 2016, the Stonies also did a signing ceremony for the a ceremony for the bison reintroduction in 2016. And both Councillor Snow and Elder Rabbit were in attendance for both of those. So maybe if we could hear a little bit about the importance of doing ceremonies, especially in the Banff area.
In regards to the reintroduction? Anin gaki gachanga chanin angavi umba chidu chino nin nana kodab ko hibina cha kinya pagan chadab chencha is no laga is chegi abna dik chegi abina gokta je no abi chen chaligi abi dik e do kya chu chani na gune chi alta island pe chi kibi ke te chi chegi ab ken stu ken chani ho re asti je no
Ako sto ga bine. Ako dandu chi ha, ko re chi. Omen chi ya bisin sanu, shaga omen. Stone chin de, he cha de he chi omen to ga ne, ko ne chi. On cha sin chi ya ga bisin na. Che chi Indian de shu ha ba sin de. And non, waji hi ya sanu, tun, tiya sabi cha. Lightning. Albert Lightning Jebjo. Today, see how Jim Napa Scadab in the neck, you skim in the hunt, tongue of knob and the dang is ni maiden got Jebuna. See how who give pub one, the work of Renum is a whole job of one. It's a hana. Rather than in Damia hang agazines, no guy you dunking in the air of a son. No guy you dunking in the Khitim Tahuan.
The ceremony we did for the reintroduction of the buffalo at Banff during the Indian days was significant because back when the Indian days first started, it was just the Nakoda people that came to the Indian days. At that time, there were buffalo there at the park too, so it was always mentioned that we're gonna go back to where the sitting buffalo mountain to go visit our relatives, our buffalo that are still over there at the park. And then in those days, it was just the Stonies that were involved with the Banff Indian days, until recently, when the introduction of when we did that ceremony and invited all different nations to come and join us in that ceremony was unique. It was good. It was all bringing nations together to help to reintroduce the buffalo. When the ceremony at Elk Island was very important to through ceremony the First Nations that did attend that ceremony, all the different nations that came there, the ceremony that was done was important because the spirit of the animal, the connection, the ceremony is based on connecting with the spirit of the animal. So through ceremony, the animal was given information about the intent of what is going to happen in the future, that they're going to be reintroduced back into the wild up at Panther River. So that was very important, the elder says, that because we still have the ceremonies, we're still able to connect with the buffalo. So it was important that all nations gather together to make this happen, to try to work together as people to reintroduce the buffalo.
One of the things that I remember from attending all of these different ceremonies, whether in Banff or at Elk Island, but especially the one at Elk Island, I remember there was a really good feeling among all the people after the ceremony was done. People were very joyous. It was like a really important occasion for people to see and to be part of, to know that this is going to happen. And so that's one of the things I remember, is that really good feeling that came after the ceremony was done. The two ceremonies that were done at Elk Island, we had set up two teepees, one to represent Treaty 6 and another teepee to represent Treaty 7. And that was to symbolize that the buffalo are moving from Elk Island in Treaty 6 to Banff National Park in Treaty 7. And we had the the Cree bands, Samson Cree, who was took part in our signing ceremony in 2015. They were the host nation, so they had their they were the lead for the ceremony for the Treaty 6 bands. And then Stoney was able to coordinate with the other Treaty 7 bands to do the ceremony for Treaty 7, receiving that buffalo into those lands. So, but again, that was a really good feeling that I had when I was there taking part in the, participating in the whole ceremony. Maybe the elder, or if you want to talk a bit about your feelings afterwards when that ceremony was done at Elk Island.
Elk Island at Chigabiki, Nustam Kedaha, Doninkabu, Wachuni Pabise. Chandicta.
Chim Pabiji Chandicta. Chigabise, said Chue, Tinjagi, he wouldn't Chigabinde. Jawa Kanda, my coach and then was Chigabis youngsters yet that bit here.
Yes, the ceremony was very it was it left a very good feeling in the heart to hear the ceremony is still very much alive, still very powerful, and the beautiful songs that were sung for the buffalo, and the strength of it was very powerful, and the buffalo when they were released back in Panther River, we were watching through TV. The excitement that they had to be back in that area, you could tell by how they were running and kicking and the excitement. I think due to the fact that through ceremony they were informed that this is the intent of what is going to happen in their future.
Okay, I think we'll go through the panel and we'll get some closing comments on their understanding or maybe their feelings about the bison reintroduction that's been happening. So maybe we can start with Melanie.
Sure, I think it's symbolic, and I think it's a very symbolic step in reconciliation, and I would, on behalf of Alberta Parks, we're very supportive of Banff National Park's initiative to restore bison to the landscape, and we'd like to see in the future more restoration on the landscape, possibly within Alberta Park lands, where it's feasible and where it will set the bison up for success. So I'm so grateful to the Stoney Nakoda Nation for the role that you've played in making this happen.
Nuchib noga nuchib tubas imcha naabri duken chani mi eh imcha.
Naam chi na buan hingi na buan na nuchib hito ubine. Ipu gan na hiti noga na hikta. Sydney hoga mahun sapa binne hun sapa bi chi ya buan ja un ja ti ja be chum cha sin pa ne cha na ban ma chi gi bi na in che go bi chon e cha na
Yes, the buffalo to be reintroduced back into the park is there's no let's see if I can capture this. There's nothing different about it. They were part of the landscape to begin with. So they were brought back here where they originally were in the first place. When we were put here on Earth, the buffalo were put here along with us. And we were taught along with the buffalo how to celebrate creation. And so coming back to the original place of in history is very pleasant. That's what he said. So I guess in my mind, it's very interesting. I think because the park. The park is, there's two other parks, I think, that have already have buffalo free, roaming free with inside the park. I think Yellowstone and Wood Buffalo National Park. So this is going to be the third one. But I think Banff was the first park that was ever created. So now it would be interesting to see how other animals, other animals like the wolves, for example, the challenges that two rivals will run into again. I think that has been through centuries. So it would be interesting to see how each animal strives or how they survive. So I think it's going to be a battle on both sides, you know, not only, you know, we think that through culture, through understanding as a people, you know, we reintroduce a buffalo back into the park, but there's probably a lot more to it than that. There's an ecosystem that's going to change also because of the different animals that work with the buffalo. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in the future for our children. I don't know if we're going to see it, but it'll be an interesting change overall. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think for myself, I think it's a very good initiative by Parks Canada, and we are very supportive of this. When we first heard about the bison reintroduction, Stony Nakoda Nation. So, and you know, we've taken actions to make sure that we have all of the right ceremonies done in accordance with that. Bringing our signing ceremonies to culturally important and appropriate areas. And it's a very good thing because I believe that we have that the importance of buffalo in our culture has always been there and it continues to be there. And so when we see a project like bison reintroduction taken on by parks, we want to support that and we want to make sure that it's very successful because it means much more than just bringing an animal back to a landscape. It means all of the cultural importance that goes with it, the ecological importance, the wildlife importance that's attached to it. So for all of those reasons, cultural, environmental, spiritual, all of those important factors, it's a very good thing and it will benefit, I think, all of the wildlife and people and the ecosystem in that area. So I want to thank everyone for coming out today and being part of the panel, sharing your thoughts and your memories of the reintroduction process and want to thank Canadian Mountain Network for taking the time to come out and work with Stony Nakoda Nation here in the Canmore Nordic Center here in Canmore, Alberta, and thank you.
Special thanks to our panelists, to Meg Wilcox, our host, and to the University of Alberta and the Faculty of Science for supporting this podcast.